By the way, I brought up a copy of the book that we're going to be using in small groups. It's by Jay Pathick and Dave Runyon. It's called The Art of Neighboring. And we're encouraging those of you who come to small groups to buy a copy, because we'll be using the discussion questions at the back of the book. I read this book a few months ago, and as I read it, I discovered it's not a heavy book. It's one of those books that if you are looking for deep theology, you may think, this is pretty straightforward. But I hope that you won't let the simplicity of the idea of being good neighbors derail you from the importance. And that's what we're going to be talking about today and for the next 6 weeks. In fact, I realize that as I begin my message this morning, I've got a big challenge. I would like to see a good percentage of you get involved in our small group studies. I know that's not going to work with everybody's schedule. I know it's not going to be possible for everybody, but I'd love to see perhaps a few of you who are on the fence thinking about it to get involved. For those of you who can't get involved in a study, I hope you'll order the book online. There's copies on the back table if you need to know what you're supposed to order. But I hope you'll take seriously that this is an interesting opportunity. And I also realize, as challenging as it is to get people involved in a study and getting men especially to read a book, that this is important stuff. And that's what I want, hopefully, to impress upon you this morning. Now, I realize that probably most of you weren't kept awake last night, tossing and turning, wondering, can I be a better neighbor? Oh, I need to be a better neighbor. It's not one of those topics that is a felt need. And yet, it's a topic that's of utmost importance. Because, as Steve mentioned, it really sums up the Bible in many ways. As I've thought about this this topic, as I thought about this morning and trying to impress upon you the importance of this topic, there was one passage of Scripture that stood out to me. In fact, not only did the passage stand out to me, but the sermon stood out to me, because it's the story that we're going to look at from Luke chapter 10. The parable of the Good Samaritan. This is a story that has been impressed upon me because of being my father's son. I probably heard him preach the parable of the Good Samaritan as much as any sermon I ever heard him preach. And in all candor and honesty, I am borrowing heavily from his messages I share with you today, because the main idea of the passage is one that I hear in my head as I reflect upon this. But I want to have you just listen to these words from Luke chapter 10, and then we're going to talk about them. Begins in verse 25, a very familiar story, but a very important one. On one occasion, an expert of the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? He replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this, and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? In reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell into the hands of robbers, and they stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert of the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." One of the challenges of preaching this passage is it's a familiar story. In fact, the idea of Good Samaritan is an idea that has made its way into popular American English. People probably who don't even know this story know the idea of being a Good Samaritan. But oftentimes, it's our familiarity with the story that causes us to miss its importance. And so I hope you'll allow me to reacquaint you with this story to help you see it from the perspective of the people who Jesus first told it to. Because until we see it the way they see it, until we feel it the way they felt it, we may miss out on the importance of what it is we're embarking on for the next 6 weeks in our small groups and sermon series. There's a man who came to Jesus. And the New International Version says he was an expert in the law. Some of your versions, if you have a different version, might say he was a lawyer. He wasn't a lawyer in the sense of a person who passed the Jerusalem bar exam. He was a person who knew the Jewish law. He was an expert, and really I think we could understand him and recognize him better as a theologian. And he came to Jesus with a question. Now, this wasn't just a totally honest question. There was definitely a barb to it, because we're told he came to test Jesus. I pulled out about 6 different commentaries on Luke, because I kind of figured they would all tell me what this testing was all about, and not one of them really explained it. But it seems to me that for this man to be testing Jesus, he had one of 2 objectives in mind. Either he was trying to demonstrate Jesus' orthodoxy or unorthodoxy, or trying to show Jesus to be not all that he claimed to be. Maybe not as capable and great a teacher. So this question was a question that was asked to expose Jesus, to show him to be less than this great teacher that he was known to be. So the purpose of the question was to trip Jesus up. And the question is a profound question. It's one of those questions that is kind of at the heart of every religion. He says, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" A pretty important question. In some ways, every religion is trying to get at that. How do I have a life with God? So as he asked the question, I think he figured, whatever Jesus says, I'm either going to expose that he doesn't follow God's law or he doesn't understand it well. And he figured that he would have Jesus in his hand. But it didn't quite work out that way. Jesus just turned around, and instead of answering his question, he asked him another question. He said, "You're a teacher of the law. You're supposed to know the law. What does the law say?" And so the legal expert said, "Well, the but to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus hadn't answered the question. He had had to answer his own question, and it was such an obvious answer that the man was defeated before he ever began. But Jesus says something interesting to the man. He says, "Do this, and you will live." If you really think about this question, this statement, the summary of the law, you realize that it's not easy to do. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind. When was the last day of your life where every single moment was consumed with that focus? You might cut yourself some slack and say, I do that most of the time. I mean, maybe not perfectly, but I kind of do it sometimes. But the part that really trips us up, and the part that we're going to spend some time talking about in the course of our study together, is the second part of this great commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. You realize the problem with that? How do you decide who you have to love? I mean, I guess I'm supposed to love people in the church. That's not very easy. But I guess I'm supposed to do that. And I'm probably supposed to love my family. Is that it? Well, that was the question this man asked. Who is my neighbor? That question, if we really spend some time thinking about it, can change the way we live our lives. And my hope is, as we spend time talking about it and thinking about it, it will change some of the things that we do. So how did Jesus answer? What was Jesus' answer to this man? Well, he didn't answer him by giving him a lecture, saying, okay, I want you to know 3 points, and make sure that you have them all down, and I'll explain it to you, and then you follow that, and you'll be good. No, he tells this story, this familiar story that we just read. The challenge of the story, however, is we read it from a jaded 21st century perspective. We see who the good guys are, we see who the bad guys are, and we kind of have the punchline figured out, and in the process, we miss the punch and the power of the story. So I'd like us to re-look at this familiar story and to kind of enter into the story and to see it from a first century perspective, from a perspective of the people who were on the road. This story took place in a road that actually exists, still does exist today. It's the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. It was called the Bloody Way because it was known to be a way that was very dangerous, a place where many muggings took place. It was a barren stretch of about 17 miles that descended from Jerusalem down to Jericho, descended about 3,300 feet vertically over 17 miles. And it was barren, deserty land. And there weren't lots of homes, there weren't lots of people, but there were robbers who would hang out there. So Jesus tells about a man who made this trip from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And while he was on his way, he was mugged. He was beaten and he was left on the road, basically dead. Now the question that Jesus has asked is, who is the neighbor to this man? Well, I suppose the answer to that question depends on who you ask. The story tells us about a priest, a Levite, and a Samaritan, and of course this poor, unfortunate man. And if you were to try to decide who the neighbor was to this man, I suppose we should start with him. Sir, we're taking a little survey. Who do you think would be a good neighbor to you? My suspicions are his answer would be as wide as the world. I mean, anybody who comes down this road who helps me out, he's a neighbor. I'm not going to be too picky in this situation. So for him, clearly, his neighbor was just somebody who would lend a hand. But there were other travelers who went down the road, and that's where we discover that when we kind of enter into their skin and we see things from their perspective, we realize that we're probably more like some of the people we see as the bad guys and less like the people we see as the good guys. The first person who comes down the road is a priest. Now, in that day, that time, a priest, just to kind of put it in a context, would have been like the pastor of the church. So let's say you're the mugging victim, you're laying on the side of the road, and you see the pastor of your church, Pastor Tory Robinson, coming down the street, and you think, God, you have blessed me. You've delivered me. And certainly, that's what, if this man was even conscious, he must have thought. The priests would recite these very words that this expert in the law had said. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. This was something they said every day. So if ever there was somebody you wanted to come to meet your need, it was somebody who knew the law, somebody who knew what was required of them. And so he walks down the road. He looks at the man. And it says, and he passed by on the other side. Why would he do that? That's one of the major questions that people have when they read this story and reflect upon it. And Jesus doesn't answer it. We'll look at it in just a minute. There's a second person who came along. That was a Levite. If the first guy was the pastor of the church, the second guy was the Steve Armstrong of the church, the associate pastor. And if the first guy didn't help out, I'm sure this man thought, well, no wonder he didn't. There's somebody else who'll come along. But Jesus said that he too went to the man and saw him. And then he passed by on the other side. Why didn't they stop? Well, we don't know. It's just conjecture, but we know people. We know that people have all kinds of reasons for what we do. Perhaps the priest, the senior pastor, thought, you know, I have worked hard in the temple. It says he was heading from Jerusalem to Jericho, so he's probably finished his work, maybe heading back home. And he's been away from his family for a long time. And he realizes that whatever happens with this man, it's going to take a lot of time. And maybe he just doesn't have it. I don't know that that's what he said. Jesus doesn't tell us that's what he said, but you and I understand that. Actually, many of the commentators on this this passage, say that perhaps the main reason why the priest and maybe even the Levite did not stop was because of the laws of uncleanness. You see, if you were a Jew and you came in contact with a dead body, you were unclean. And here, as a religious man, he would have to be unable to perform his duties for a period of time until he was clean again. And he may have thought, you know, this man is dying. He might die in my arms, and then I will be unable to do my duty to God. Now, we realize that's a lame excuse, but have you ever had a lame excuse? Have you ever used God as an excuse for doing something God might want you to do? I don't know. I'm not sure what it was that caused the priest to stop. I don't know what it was that caused the Levite to not stop. But one other possibility is it's not hard to imagine that this man laying by the side of the road was just the first of a few different mugging victims. The next people that came along very well could be the next victim. These muggers could still be hiding in the rocks. And so perhaps the priest, perhaps the Levite, perhaps both of them just said, this isn't safe. I mean, if it happened to him, it could happen to me. For whatever reason, they passed by on the other side. Again, we think, why would they do that? Why would religious people, people who understand the commands of God's law, why would they do that? Well, have you ever done that? You drive along the road and there's somebody on the side of the road and their car is broken down and you pass by. Now, in fairness, there are lots of reasons why we pass by. These people are not dying. That's a major reason. We think, you know, if it were a wreck, we would stop, and probably most of us would. But have you ever been broken down on the side of the road? Sue had an occasion some years ago that was what got us into the modern cell phone era. We had no cell phone, and her car broke down, and she was stranded on the turnpike for hours. Nobody came along. Finally, she had to walk someplace, and I found myself wondering, would she have wanted somebody to come along? I mean, certain people you kind of want, other people you don't want. It's a tough situation. But certainly when you're stuck someplace, you wish people would come by and help. We don't. We figure, well, you know, probably in this day and age, they're going to have a cell phone. They probably have AAA. They're probably going to be fine. Maybe so. There aren't absolute answers. I have a feeling that probably this week, some of us are going to drive by somebody on the side of the road. I can't always say that you have an obligation to stop for every stranded motorist, but if you have wondered whether you should and you've chosen not to, then you can understand the dilemma that people feel. And if anyone should have felt the dilemma, if anyone should have felt the need, it was this priest and this Levite. They knew what the law commanded, and yet they chose to move on. So who was it who came along to help this mugging victim? See if you can answer this for me. Fill in the blank. He was a good Samaritan. Now, that, as I said at the outset, In our day and time, that terminology has made its way into the English language. And we talk about people as good Samaritans. But you know what? As the people were listening to Jesus talk, those two words didn't go together. Good and Samaritan. You have to realize that Jesus was telling this story to a bunch of Jews. And Jews hated Samaritans, and Samaritans returned the favor. They hated Jews. It would be like today saying a terrorist, a good terrorist. I mean, it doesn't equate. But there was such animosity between these two groups that for the Jews to think of a Samaritan as being good, it just didn't compute. So certainly, this man laying on the side of the road, if he were to pick who his neighbor was, he would, the last person, if the priest was on the top of the list, the very bottom of the list would have been the Samaritan. And that's where this story has its twist. The bad guy ends up being the good guy, and the good guy ends up being the bad guy. If you've been in that audience when Jesus told the story, chances are you're probably thinking, this is interesting. The priest went by, the Levite went by. Jesus' hero of the story is just going to be a run-of-the-mill, everyday Jew. And I think that was kind of what people were waiting for. But when Jesus said, no, the hero of the story was somebody that in that culture was vilified, it didn't compute. And yet, the Samaritan was the one who stopped. He was the one who saw the man in need and took care of his need. And the text tells us, it's interesting, in about the same amount of time as it has taken to explain all that has taken until now, Luke slows down the story and tells us all the things that this Samaritan did. It says, he went to him, he bandaged his wounds in verse 34, pouring on oil and wine. And then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn and there took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. This Samaritan was maybe not considered a good man, but he was a good neighbor because he met the man's need. So Jesus, it's interesting, as he asked this legal expert, this Jewish expert, he says, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell in the hands of the robbers? Notice how he answers. The expert of the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. You know why he replied that way, don't you? He didn't even want to take the name Samaritan on his lips. So he didn't even give credence to that. He just said, that one who showed mercy. And that's where our definition comes in. Who is our neighbor? Of all the people that you and I have around us, who are the people, if we're going to talk about neighboring, if we're going to be practical about this, who are our neighbors? What we look for, honestly, is we look for caveats that say, I don't have to be responsible for this person. I don't have to care about that person. Do you know that the priests and the Levites, there were some rabbis who said that if you were a foreigner, if you were a Samaritan, you didn't need to be helped. Maybe that was the reason why the priests and the Levite didn't stop. They the man on the road was apparently a Jew, but they somehow may have decided that there was something about him that was suspect, so they wrote him off. Again, we don't know. But what I can tell you is that we have our own little reasons why we do what we do and why we don't do what we don't do. But who is our neighbor? Well, the neighbor is anyone. Anyone whose need I see, whose need I am able to meet. That definition of neighbor, that's a definition I picked up from my dad a long time ago, and a definition that fits this story. Because notice in the story, it says that each of these men going down the road clearly saw the man. It says, verse 31, a priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came to where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. All three men saw the same thing, but all three men didn't see the same thing. The priest saw an interruption to his time. The Levite saw danger. Or whatever it was, somehow something else stood out to them that was more important to them than this person's need. But it was the Samaritan who saw the man and took pity on him. So a neighbor is anyone whose need I see, whose need I am in a position to meet. That's a huge definition. But if we think about it, we realize it gives us a huge obligation. As we realize, here's somebody and I'm the person who can help them. Sometimes we realize I'm not the person who can help them. Maybe the car is broken down and you know you have no mechanical abilities whatsoever. You don't have a cell phone. You can't call on their behalf. You think, I can't really help them. But then again, maybe it's a lonely road and you're not a great mechanic, but you have a cell phone and you can stop and render aid. If you see a need and you know you can somehow meet it, you have the opportunity to be a good neighbor. Now, being a good neighbor isn't always easy, because good neighbors, well, they're oftentimes the person we are neighbors to may be somebody that's unknown to us. It's not hard to be a good neighbor to somebody that you care about who lives next door, but if it's a smelly bum on the street who you think, you know, he really needs a meal, that's more taxing for us. Sometimes it's not just somebody who's unknown to us, but somebody who is unlovely. Again, that bum probably fit that qualification. Or maybe it's an annoying neighbor that you just think, you know, I wish they'd just leave me alone. I don't like them very much. Now, there are different ways that these neighbors can present themselves, whether they're unlovely or unknown. But nevertheless, if you see a need and you can meet it, you and I have the opportunity to be neighbors to those people. And think about it. Being a neighbor, this is the hard part. This is where this series, we talk about it. Being a neighbor sounds so good in the abstract. Helping people and healing people and getting people up off the road and having them thankful. In fact, that's another reason perhaps why we are our neighbors sometimes. Because people, we know they're going to be grateful to us. But some people are very ungrateful. that can make it hard to be a neighbor. But if you see a need and you can meet it, that's your responsibility. That's my responsibility. This meeting this need was not easy for this man. It involved time. He spent at least a couple days. He put the man on his donkey, took him down to an inn, stayed with him overnight, and then he even went back the next day. So when you decide to be a neighbor, maybe to somebody on your block, you need to realize, realistically, it takes time to be a good neighbor. And many of us are in short supply when it comes to time. Maybe we need to rethink where our priorities are. And it can cost money. We're told that he pulled out for the innkeeper 2 silver coins and gave it to the innkeeper. In the footnote of your New International Version, it tells us that the Greek word, a denarii, 1 denarii was worth the equivalent of a workman's wage. So a day's wage for a workman was 1 denarii. This is 2 denarii. It was several $100 this man forked out for this stranger. And if you're going to be a good neighbor, it may cost you money. But why do we do it? Why would we be willing to do that? Well, this is where this comes down to us. Remember, I pointed out that each of these men came along the road and they saw this mugging victim. But what they saw really was not the same thing. You see, Christian love is subjective, not objective. What I mean by that is that if you are the object of my love, I love you because of who you are, because of what you can do for me, because of what I get out of the relationship. But Christian love is not that way. It's not based on the person being loved. It's based on the person doing the loving. And if we're to be God's people, then we need to let God's love work in us. You remember that over in 1 John, it talks about those who love God, claim to love God, but hate their brothers or liars. Why is that? Because God is a God of love, and if we are people who have God's love in us, then that will enable us to be loving people. God's love enables us to be good neighbors. It enables us to have this love that is not based on what the person can do for me, but just what I can do for that person. The whole focus of being a good neighbor is built on who we are as followers of Jesus Christ. I told you that I was influenced by my father's message. Some of you, probably 12 years ago or so, I think my dad preached on the Good Samaritan here. And one of the stories that I love from that sermon that I got to repeat to you is that who you are determines what you see. And if you are a person who has Christ in your life, it should show up in your relationship with other people. There's that nursery rhyme that we all have heard that teaches that. Pussycat, pussycat, where have you been? I've been to London to see the Queen. Pussycat, pussycat, what saw you there? I saw a great big mouse sitting under her chair. As you think about that, the depth of that nursery rhyme, it may never have struck you that it's very deep, but the fact is, here's a cat who's been to London. Our family got to go to London last year. And, you know, there's so many things to see in London and so much history in that town, that city. And here's a cat who's seen it all. Not only has she seen the Tower of London and the London Eye, she has been to Buckingham Palace and not just stood out there like the rest of us. She got in with an audience to see the Queen. And so the cat's back at home showing us her slides online, you know, and we're looking at the pictures. And he said, you got into Buckingham Palace? The cat said, yeah, I did. Was the Queen in residence? Yes, I suppose she was. Well, Pussycat, tell me what was she like? I mean, now she's getting up there in age. Was she alert? Did she look nice? Guess what? I frankly didn't notice. You didn't notice. You were in the throne room of the Queen and you didn't notice. What, Pussycat, what did you see? So, well, under her chair was the biggest morsel of a mouse you would ever imagine. Because pussycats have pussycat hearts. And they're concerned about mice instead of monarchs. Who we are determines what we see. So if we are to be people who see a need, we need to reflect on who we are. If we know the God who is a God of love, who is concerned enough to send His Son for us when we were still sinners, unlovely, unwanted, unable to repay Him, if that infects and affects our lives, then that will change the way we look at the people around us. What we see determines what we do. What we do is determined by who we are. If we are to be good neighbors, our neighbors are anyone whose need we see, whose need we are able to meet. They may live next door to you. They may be people you run into at work. But in this art of neighboring, your neighbor is as big as the world. And so that means, how in the world do we do this? That's what we're going to be talking about for the next 6 weeks. It's a pretty big topic, really, when you think about it. And yet it is a summation of all that the Old Testament taught. Because it brings us back to our relationship with God. I hope you'll get the book. I hope you read the parable. I hope, like me, you'll do some business with God and ask, what does God want of me? Let's bow together. Lord God, I thank You for Your Son, Jesus. He came to liberate me from my sin, but I dare not settle there. You called me to a whole new way of life. Father, I pray that You would help us to not be complacent, to not make excuses, to not live with blinders on to people that are around us who we can care for. Thank You, Lord, for this simple story that probes the depths of our hearts. I ask that we might please You by the people we care about and how we care about them. We ask these things for Jesus' sake, the sake of His kingdom, and the sake of those around us whose lives we can impact with Your love and grace.